Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Why, my good fellow, you look a bit mad.
Why, I am a bit mad. How did you know? Are you a physician?
Well, of course. Didn't you notice my physician's cap?
You mean that beautiful tin funnel on your head?
Yes, of course. Now, if you would, can you point to the part of your body that feels insane?
Oh, right here in the skull, Doc. right here in the skull.
Ah, then that's where the stone of madness awaits us.
Can you remove it, Doc?
Why, certainly. Just have a seat and allow me to trepan your cranium just large enough to remove the stone.
Oh, better make it a big hole, Doc. I'm about as mad as they come. I married two rats to a bowl of porridge yesterday. Sometimes I wake up in a field and I think I'm a dog. I start chasing the local clergy around and everything.
Yes, it's going to be all right. Now, just let me reach inside. Ah, there it is. The stone of madness and folly. The source of your mental maladies, surgically removed. That'll be 5 silver.
Oh, here you go. But can I keep the stone?
Of course you can.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
I hope you enjoyed our little skit. That is our attempt to audibly capture the spirit of a particular painting, namely... the cutting of the stone, or the extraction of the stone of madness, or the cure of folly, whatever you want to call it, by Hieronymus Bosch. This is a painting from around 1494, and it depicts this sort of crazy but highly allegorical surgery taking place.
Yeah, if you have never seen this painting, you should look it up. I'm going to do my thing and tell you to Google an image, but you really should see it to go with this episode. It'll be on the landing page
of the
web version of this episode. But it's a painting by Hieronymus Bosch. It's usually dated to around 1500 sometime. We read one source that said it had to be after 1502. Mm-hmm. Other people date it to the 1490s.
As we mentioned in the past when we dealt with some of Bosch's work, there's so little known about him that it's there's a certain amount of mystery involved in all of this.
And one of the great things about it is the mystery of what motivated this painting, because what's happening in the painting, the cutting of the stone of madness, you have a patient in the sort of the center left of the frame who is seated in a chair in the middle of a field, and he looks quite distressed, and he's reclining back in the chair as a man in a pink robe with a tin funnel on his head cuts into the patient's scalp.
Yes.
And the man with the tin funnel on his head who's doing the cutting, he looks fairly serene, wouldn't you say?
Yes, he seems dedicated to the task at hand here.
Which you could interpret as concentration and, you know, knowing what he's doing, or you could interpret as a kind of callousness and insensitivity to this man's apparent grunting. He looks like he's in the middle of a really good grunt.
Yeah.
Then to the right of the guy reclining in the chair who's having his head cut open, you have what appears to be, you think this is a monk?
Yeah, it looks very much like a monk.
Yeah, he's got a shaved top of his head, and he's in some black garments. And then to the right of the monk, there is a woman with her head covered by a cloth in a dress draped over her with a book sitting on top of her head that's clasped with a clasp. So what on earth do we make of this painting?
I should also note that there is text with this painting.
Right.
If you have the appropriate zoomed out version. And it says, this translation, of course, "Master, cut away the stone. My name is Lubert Das."
Lubert Das.
Yeah. And this is apparently a fool in Dutch literature of the time. And,
yeah.
And the observer, the viewer of this particular piece would have known that.
Yeah, I think at the time, calling a character Lubbert is kind of like us calling a character Cletus or something like that.
Yeah.
It's like a joke name.
The Dutch Cletus, if you will. Yeah. So that's one of the key paintings that we're going to keep referring back to. But we see an overall trend, in medieval art.
Medieval and early modern art in Europe that seems to be following this theme set up by Bosch, or at least first interpreted by Bosch as far as we know, this theme of cutting out the stone of madness. So in the previous painting, we had the guy with the tin funnel hat cutting the guy's head. He seems to be in the process of removing this titular stone, the stone of madness, whatever that is. But there are other paintings. There's, of course, a cutting of the stone of madness by Bruegel, right?
Yeah, Peter Bruegel the Elder, who lived 1515 to 1569, responsible for a number of fabulous pieces that I'm sure everyone's familiar with, or maybe even had on your dorm room wall in college. I know I did. And this one shows, this one has a number of individuals and several different neurosurgical procedures going on in very crude and horrific fashion.
Now, we can point out that this painting, you should also look this one up so you can see it for yourself, but it's much more chaotic than the last one. The last one is a sort of a concentrated scene of a single cutting taking place. It's a madhouse. There are people all over having their heads examined and cut, and multiple people doing the cutting. There's just general chaos. People are squatting and squirming in the background and trying to peek in and see what's going on. It looks like a bad scene.
Yeah, and definitely remember the madhouse a bit, because we'll come back to that. The third painting we want to reference here is one by Quentin Massies. He lived 1466 to 1529, and this one is called An Allegory of Folly. And this one is probably my favorite of the three, just because it's so monstrous and weird.
Yeah, now it doesn't depict a surgery.
Right.
But it does depict, it follows the same theme of the stone of madness. There seems to be, so you see a guy here, he looks like he is perhaps mentally unsound in some way, and he is clutching a staff that, what is going on at the top of the staff, Robert?
Well, there are evidently a number of different symbols going on in this piece. There's so much symbology at play in these paintings, and we don't have time to tease it all apart. But yeah, he has a staff that has like a small individual that is with exposed buttocks emerging from the staff. He has a rooster on his head. And he doesn't seem in pain by his madness. He seems a little mischievous, bemused.
No, he seems to be contemplating the act of marrying two rats to a bowl of porridge.
He does, yes.
And on his forehead, there is a lump that you can see. It's a visible lump bulging from his forehead that appears to be this stone. It's the stone of madness.
Yeah, it looks very much, in a way, it also looks kind of like a third eye, which is, I think, something that's kind of neat about this piece, that if you look at it with other artistic traditions loaded into your head, it kind of makes you wonder about, you know, the whole difference between enlightenment and madness, which will be a theme we come back to. But yeah, it looks like the stone of madness is not only in this individual's head, but it's poking through.
Yeah. And so these are just a few examples, but this seems to be a general theme emerging in medieval and early modern European art of the stone of madness being a stone in the head associated with madness as they would understand it, and the act of cutting for the stone to get it out. But does this refer to a real physical thing in any way? And does the act of cutting for it represent a surgical procedure that really took place?
Yeah, it's an interesting mystery to consider, because ultimately you have like three possibilities here.
Yeah.
One is that, yes, there's something going on here. There's some physical malady in the head that is being removed.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Another possibility is that this is all a charlatan's game, right?
Right.
That that a quack is coming along and saying, oh, you have a problem. Well, I can take care of that. I can remove the source of it.
It's like cranial psychic surgery, you know.
Yeah.
The psychic surgeon would kind of scoop on your stomach for a bit and then sneak some chicken guts into his hand and pretend to be pulling things out of your body.
Exactly.
In this case, you'd have somebody cutting at your head and then by sleight of hand sneaking a stone into the hand and saying, well, look what I pulled out of your brain. You know, here's the problem.
Yeah, it would. Yeah, in this case, it would be precisely psychic surgery. I imagine a lot of people have seen this depicted in the movie Man in the Moon, the movie about Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
Where he goes and this is performed for him. And yeah, and they would often, sometimes it would be chicken guts, but other times it would be inorganic objects.
Yeah.
And so you throw in a little magic, a little superstition, and you can easily imagine the scenario in which this essentially a medieval witch doctor of sorts, a charlatan, comes and, here's the stone. I've removed it, and now you are well.
Yeah. Another option would be that there wasn't actually a stone in the head.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a real problem that was being addressed here. And it wasn't quackery, but it was just somebody who was well-meaning thought that there was some kind of thing that could be done to the head or something removed from the head to actually cure people. And it just didn't work. You know, they were wrong, but they were well-meaning.
So that's what we're going to explore in today's episode. We're going to be talking a little bit about medieval surgery. We're going to be talking about trepanation. We're going to be talking about, the removal of actual stones from the body, particularly in the Middle Ages. And we'll get back around to what experts think this painting, this artistic tradition is really saying.
Well, I think first we should take a look at the general atmosphere of surgery in the Middle Ages and then bridging into the early modern period here. One of the things that I think about when we think back on medieval medicine is that it's easy for us to look back and make fun of people in the Middle Ages for believing in ridiculous cures, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh, you've got migraines? You need to look at an ugly baby for 13 minutes and then sprinkle some ground up boar tusk in your eye.
Right.
We all know that's not going to work. It seems ridiculous to us. Like, how did people fall for that? They must have been so stupid. But I'm not sure that's the case, because considering the known alternatives at the time, this superstitious kind of try anything approach starts to make more sense. In the Middle Ages, if you were smart, the known alternatives, especially surgery, were often a last resort, and especially surgery.
Yeah, to open up the body, particularly the body cavity, was a very dangerous proposition.
Yeah, so you may have heard about this term barber surgeon, mm-hmm. right? You've probably heard the story that, hey, you know, why do barber poles have this spinning red and white kind of twirl on them? Is it because they love candy canes and Christmas, or is it just an accident? Well, no, the fact you probably heard about that is that came from, you know, bloodletting,
yeah.
essentially saying this is a place where you can get your blood let. So while the scientific ignorance of people in medieval Europe is sometimes, I think, a little bit overstated, like sometimes we underestimate just how smart people in the past were about things, medieval surgery was still probably about as scary as you're imagining.
Yeah.
One of the things about the time is that academic physicians, the people who really studied the body, the closest equivalent to what we would think of as doctors today.
These would be the learned individuals who had some degree of access to medical texts.
Yeah. They studied in universities. They knew what was up. They may have done dissections and stuff like that, but much of the actual cutting in surgery was not done by these people. So you had your experts who were the physicians, and then separately you had these barber surgeons or these traveling surgeons who were more just kind of like skilled people who, you know, they have a skill they can apply. So I can cut hair, I can cut stones out, I can cure cataracts. In many cases, the authors who wrote surgical treatises of the time admitted that they had never performed the operations they were describing.
Oh, wow.
And in a way, it kind of makes sense because, you know, an old barber cuts your hair or shaves your head if you're a monk, and they shave your beard. So they've got the razor. Why not apply the razor to other things that need cutting? Like maybe if they need to extract some bone fragments from a club strike crush wound, or if they need to do some bloodletting, which truly was very common at the time.
Yeah. And plus, I would imagine their status is already one in which they have close contact to the bodies of others. Whereas I could imagine that being less the case for, you know, learned individual.
Yeah, and there's even a line in the Hippocratic Oath. You know, the Hippocratic Oath is from Hippocrates, the Greek physician. He has a part of the Hippocratic Oath that says, and this is for doctors, I will not use the knife, not even on sufferers from the stone, but will withdraw in favor of such men as are engaged in this work.
Oh, wow.
So this is, you know, doctor saying, I'm not going to do any surgery. kind of strange attitude for us to consider, but that was the thought at the time.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the medieval barber surgeon TV show. You know, we would have the medical dramas playing out, but the individual who has all the theories and all the learning, they're not actually going to do any of the cutting. That goes to the secondary character.
Now, this does still sort of apply today because, of course, we still have medical specializations. You have somebody who is, you know, they focus on maybe family medicine versus somebody who's a neurosurgeon. Obviously, they wouldn't try to do each other's job.
Right.
You know, they have medical specialization. So that still carries through to today to some extent. But we're not, in this case, letting barbers do the neurosurgery.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Uses directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, why was surgery so dangerous in the Middle Ages and so just so generally awful? Well, one of the things that medieval surgeons did not have is sterile equipment or even knowledge of the need for antiseptic surgical methods. Like, for example, there was a common belief at the time that pus was just an important part of the healing process and that there were a few medieval surgeons who tried things like washing wounds with wine, but it really wasn't until following Joseph Lister in the 1860s that antiseptic surgery started to catch on everywhere and become the new norm. So you might have had a few people who got the right idea early on, but it was not widespread practice to practice antiseptic surgery.
So then this is one of the reasons, this is the primary reason why any opening of the body, any surgical opening is almost invariably going to become infected because of the lack of sterility.
Putting dirty things deep inside your body, it's not good for you.
Like a grubby hand reaching in to pull a stone out of your lower abdomen.
Who may have just been handling chicken guts for all you know. I mean, who knows? Or collecting dead rats for the town's local bounty. So there's that. They also did not have effective anesthesia and pain control. And this, I mean, you can imagine in your head exactly what the problem is, but maybe you're not imagining the extent to which this is a problem. It's not just that it hurts for the patient. It's difficult to perform internal surgery even on a very willing participant if they're awake.
Yeah, if any of you have ever, it's even difficult, I think, for a lot of us to understand because there's a level of pain we're talking about here that a lot of people have not experienced. And even if you undergo surgical procedures, thanks to anesthesia, you don't have to experience them. But I remember the one time I tried to perform a self-surgery of a sort, I had a toenail issue, which I tried to, like an ingrown issue stemming from a injury. I tried to correct it myself,
With just like a butter knife and some hemp rope?
No, you know, I had, and it wasn't, you know, quite surgery by any means, but, I tried to take care of the situation using tweezers, you know, and clippers, and the pain was just like blinding, like to where there were flashes in my eyes, and then I realized, okay, I need to actually go to a professional about this. But imagine that extrapolated to, not even self-surgery, but yeah, surgery on any individual where high levels of pain are just going to be the norm. You're going to have to strap the individual down or have two ruffians pin them to a wall or to a bed.
You got to hire some thugs to help you with your surgery.
Yeah.
And so there were some potions and stuff at the time. I mean, obviously people were aware of some types of drugs, but the point was that they didn't have, controllable anesthesia. Mm-hmm. So they could maybe give you some hemlock or, you know, these crazy potions that were just as likely to kill you as they were to put you under. So they might have had that in some scenarios, or they might have just tried to do it with you awake because they knew, looks like people die a lot of times when we anesthetize them. So this was a problem. Medieval surgery, just generally bad. Common procedures that were practiced by medieval surgeons, bloodletting. That's a big one. At the time, they believed in the, you know, humerism, like the idea that there were these four humors in the body that could get out of balance and you could fix some things by letting extra blood out. A big thing at the time was the treatment of battlefield wounds, such as the removal of arrows. And so at the time, surgery was much, much more often external, from what we know, at least. There's actually sort of a dearth of information about what surgeons in medieval Europe were doing. We don't have quite as much information on this as we would like to have. But from the records we do have, it seems surgery was very often external, such as the treatment of a surface wound or other problems near the outside of the body. And for all the reasons we've already stated, internal surgery, going deep inside the body for anything, was dangerous and rare, though it did happen for some extremely problematic things, such as bladder stones. And we will definitely get back to stones, the body's lithos, in a bit here. But I think we should first turn our attention back, thinking back on the Bosch painting and the ones that followed it, to the head.
That's right. Yeah, because essentially what's going on here, appears to be going on here, is that they are performing what we now call a craniotomy, but what has been historically known as trepanation or trepanning. In which, and this is just basically the opening of the skull, mm-hmm. the creating of a hole in the skull.
Now we find evidence of trepanation going back to before the Middle Ages in Europe. I mean, it goes back to prehistoric times.
Oh, right? Yeah, thousands of years. You see accounts of it among the ancient Egyptians, the Chinese, the Indians, the Romans, the Greeks, early Mesoamerican civilizations. A lot of interesting work has come out of South America, and I believe also in Papua New Guinea as well.
But we've even found Neolithic remains, human remains that had skulls that it had clearly had the operation performed on them and survived. Right. There's a hole in the skull.
Yeah.
And it has been smoothed over where the person didn't die from this surgery, at least not for a long time.
Yeah. And so it's often been an archaeological mystery that individuals have looked into. You know, what's going on with this skull? Is this a wound? Was this individual just, clubbed with something? Or was there some sort of a surgical procedure? And if there was a surgical procedure, why did they carry it out? Was it just purely magical? Were they trying to let a demon or spirit out of the head? Or were they trying to deal with cranial and brain injuries?
Yeah.
Because today, clinical trepanation remains a treatment for epidural and subdural hematomas. And plus, it gives us a basic surgical entry point to the brain itself.
Yeah. I mean, if you've heard about trepanation before, you think about, okay, that's just a crazy, you know, why would somebody drill a hole in the skull? It's
right.
Just because they thought there were demons, you know. But there are real medical reasons, as you're saying. And I guess we don't know what the ancients knew. You know, it's hard to say whether in some cases they may have been doing it just for superstitious reasons or they had some kind of medical prompting that was legitimate.
Yeah. And you get into, an argument back and forth over that too, because to a certain extent, archaeologists in the past have looked at some of these examples and they've said, well, there's no way that these individuals were carrying this out for a legitimate medical purposes. These are savages. These are ancient people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that they were actually dealing with, they were actually performing medical procedures to deal with head wounds, to deal with swelling of the brain due to, blunt force trauma to the skull, trying to relieve that pressure by creating this hole in the skull itself.
Yeah. But of course, trepanation doesn't have necessarily a very good record in terms of the survivability of the procedure.
Oh, no. Yeah. even by the late 19th century, only 10% of patients survived a Western trepanation due to infection. And I want to stress Western, because when you do look to some of the so-called primitive cultures out there, it seems that they actually may have had a lower mortality rate with their trepanations. Eventually we were able to bring that up, obviously, because neurosurgery is not the, a 90% mortality rate endeavor right. that it used to be.
I mean, we're just generally better at fighting off infection post-surgery now. There are a lot of reasons now that surgery in general is safer.
Yeah. And a lot of people point to, American neurosurgeon Harvey Cushing, lived 1869 through 1939, as one of the key individuals who was able to bring that neurosurgery mortality rate down to less than 10%. And ultimately ushering in the modern age of neurosurgery.
In which some people do neurosurgery just for fun.
Yeah, well, for fun or for enlightenment.
Yeah, consciousness expansion.
Yeah, I don't want to go too far off the beaten path here. But we did see the rise of often self-trepanned psychonauts mm-hmm. in the 1960s and 70s. You had this individual who was Dutch, interestingly enough, tying into the origins of our paintings here.
Like Bosch.
Yeah. Former medical student Bart Hughes lived 1934 through 2004, and he stands as voluntary trepanation's pioneering visionary.
And so he added the idea that trepanation is good for your mind, right?
Yeah, he admits this was a mescaline-induced revelation, but his whole thing is that when we became bipeds, when we rose up on two legs, it altered the way the fluids move through our brain. It altered blood flow. It also altered the movement of cerebral spinal fluid. And so he thought that this would be, he was trying to figure out how can I, get healthy flow of blood to the brain. So he considered, making a hole, in his, at the base of his spinal column to drain out some of the fluid. But he eventually decided, okay, what I'll do is I'll trepan myself. I'll make this hole in my skull. And it's important to note here, we're talking about just a hole in the skull. He's not drilling all the way into brain. But the premise here is that if you were to just remove a little bit of skull there, it would allow the pressure inside the brain to be relieved and therefore allow increased blood flow through the brain, allow a better removal of toxins. There's actually some interesting research going into this even today. And they make some kind of compelling arguments for it. but then the experts also argue that brain function is not limited by normal blood flow, and then increased brain metabolism might actually stress the system. So it's not a cut and dry situation, but you have individuals out there.
It's a cut and wet situation.
Cut and wet situation, yeah. But you have individuals out there who are very strong proponents of trepanation as a means of achieving a higher state of consciousness.
Okay, and so this informs our interpretation of the painting. How? Like, are we thinking that maybe what we're seeing in this painting is we're misunderstanding it and it's a form of trepanation, or it's just sort of related to the general concept?
Essentially, it means that if there's any kind of stone removal going on, if they're removing a stone from the brain, either in fact or merely allegorically, then they're dealing with trepanation. And certainly trepanation predated these paintings. It was practiced to some degree at the time. And it would have been known to the artists. There were woodcuts. There were instruction manuals and many of the medical texts showing how this was this procedure was carried out. So, as you probably well know, kidney stones and bladder stones are very much a reality.
Yes, they are.
And as Joe will shortly relate to us, their surgical removal is also very much reality and one that dates back to antiquity.
But is there actually such a thing as a cranial stone? I mean, we know there are mineral formations that can happen in the body. Can that happen in your brain?
Well, can it happen is a question that we'll get to.
Yeah.
Was it happening at the time? Did individuals think that this was happening?
Yeah.
in the Middle Ages and in the centuries to follow? Well, as related by Mathis Kirschel, Frederick Mall, and Philip van Kerenbroek in the paper A Stone Never Cut For, A New Interpretation of the Cure of Folly by Hieronymus Bosch, published in the journal International Urology, there's no evidence to suggest this was ever carried out in real life. There are no historical sources from the period that mention genuine or fraudulent stone operations. And I also want to add that apparently there were existing accounts of quackery that was going on in the Netherlands during the 15th and 16th century.
Oh, no doubt.
They don't mention any kind of fake stone removals or fake trepanations going on, but it was presented theatrically in performances for the masses, because clearly the painting makes us think. The painting has a lot to say, and you can imagine that extrapolated to street performances for the common individual.
Yeah, the idea was that there were plays that had scenes of the extraction of the Stone of Madness, right? Cutting for the stone and the head.
Not unlike our little drama at the beginning of this episode.
It makes you wonder, because what other types of fiction that we have today depict things going on that are plausible in the same way that cutting for the stone is a plausible thing that could have happened. You can imagine quacks cutting into people's heads, pretending to remove a stone.
Without researching it any, I would be tempted to say nefarious kidney removal while on vacation. Dangerous place. You know,
exactly. Yeah. If historians of the future look back at our fiction as a judge to see what's happening in our culture today, and they can tell the difference between fantasy and realistic fiction. You know, they don't think that Star Wars is happening in our culture today, but you know, they look at some kind of realistic drama where somebody has a kidney stolen in Las Vegas. They wake up in a bathtub full of ice. I mean, they could conclude, oh, this must have been something that happened a lot in the early 2000s. Yeah.
Because clearly it's depicted in their art.
Yeah.
And these are not, these films are not just complete works of fantasy, so therefore, maybe it happened.
Yeah.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
And that brings us back to actual stone removal, the sort of stone removals we know were carried out or attempted in many cases at the time.
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier how in the Middle Ages, coming into the early modern period, surgery really was a last resort, especially any significantly invasive surgery, deep internal surgery. That was really, really a last resort. At the time, surgeons just didn't have safe, reliable ways of putting a patient to sleep. So, as we said earlier, you have to imagine internal surgery with knives going deep inside you while you're awake. Or taking a drug that might kill you.
And that's a real Sophie's choice there.
Yeah. Right? You remember that line from the Hippocratic Oath I said where I will not cut, not even for the stone?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of an indicator that of all the things people would come to an ancient or medieval doctor begging to be cut open for, at the time when this was painful and dangerous, stones in the urinary tract have got to be some of the worst things to merit a mention like this. You know, like, so the doctor is saying, you know, of all the things that I might be tempted to do for a person that I shouldn't do, cutting for a stone has got to be near the top to merit a mention like this.
Yeah, I mean, I've never suffered the experience of having a stone in my body, but I know we have listeners who surely have, and
yeah.
I would love to hear from you and your account and how that ties into your appreciation of our episode today.
I want to read a little selection from a paper called The History of Urinary Stones in Parallel with Civilization by Ahmet Tefekli and Fatin Cezayirli. So this is what they write. During the medieval period in Europe, 1096 to 1438, there was little activity in the management of stone disease. In this era, lithotomists, and that's, you know, a person who would remove stones, the lithos, the stone for a living. Lithotomists were essentially commercial travelers moving from town to town looking for business and cutting all who came their way. Often uneducated and occasionally dishonest, some were great showmen. The procedure was generally performed in the public without anesthesia and generally lasted a few minutes. However, lithotomists were held responsible for their bad results and fined accordingly. So, as we've said, this that sounds cute, right? The surgery is dangerous. Didn't you have some stats on the mortality rates?
Yes, and these are from that A Stone Never Cut paper that I referenced earlier, and I'll include a link to that on the landing page for this episode. But around the 15th century, you saw about 50%, but our sources on that are a little
Yeah, I'd have to imagine that's approximate.
Yeah. From the 17th century up to the mid-18th century, you see variable stats. You see it as low as 2.5, but also as high as 67.8.
Sounds like it matters who's doing your stone cutting.
Yes, as well as who is undergoing the surgery. Apparently the best outcomes occurred when you had a boy suffering a small stone. The older the individual, the larger the stone, and also if the individual is female, these would all really tip the scales in favor of death.
Okay, so do we have an actual account of what, like, did anybody make records of what this was like on the ground?
Yes, they did, because these tended to be very memorable surgeries. And one that we have here today, this one actually ties into a painting, as I'll mention here in a second, but it concerns Jan de Doet, a Dutch blacksmith and a do-it-yourself lithotomist.
De Doet, huh?
Yeah.
Jan de Doet.
Jan de Doet. And so
that's just the best name for a do-it-yourself lithotomist.
It is, yeah. And there is a painting of this individual called Portrait of Jan de Doet by Carol de Savoyen, and this was painted in 1655. I'll try to include a link to this painting so you can see it.
Oh, he looks real satisfied with himself.
Yeah, describe this painting for the listeners, Joe.
Well, he's posed as if for a camera, and he's in his left hand holding up what looks like an egg, but I guess it's supposed to be a huge stone. And in his other hand, he's just kind of near the bottom of the painting, posed on a table. He's got what looks like a razor.
Yep.
He's not exactly smiling, but he's got pride in his eyes.
Yeah. And as the painting might suggest, he apparently survived at least for 5 years. But we know of his case from an account written by Nicholas Toulpe's 1672 text, Observationes Medicae. And this is just a sample translated, obviously, from that book. Only letting his brother help him, he instructed him to pull aside his scrotum while he grabbed the stone in his left hand and cut bravely in the perineum with a knife he had secretly prepared. I don't know why it was secretly prepared. And by standing again and again, managed to make the wound long enough to allow the stone to pass. To get the stone out was more difficult, and he had to stick two fingers into the wound on either side to remove it with leveraged force.
Ugh.
And it finally popped out of hiding with an explosive noise and tearing of the bladder. Now the more courageous than careful operation was completed, and the enemy that had declared war on him was safely on the ground. He sent for a healer who sewed up the two sides of the wound together.
Oh, that's just troubling.
I will note that in the painting here, Portrait of Jan de Dute, we only see him from the waist up. So God knows what the finished state
his
of things
pants
was.
Were just soaked below. In blood.
Yeah. And there are other accounts out there as well. There was one in particular that I ran across years ago, and I was trying to find it, but it involved, a royal individual or an astronomer, someone of, you know, of means and importance, who had to undergo a stone removal surgery. And it was just a bloody disaster, and they ended up dying on the table. But for the life of me, I can't remember who it was.
Ugh. Okay, so we've seen that sometimes the body grows some stones inside it. You've got these formations of mineral deposits that can be very problematic, especially depending on where they occur. Sometimes they're so problematic, medieval surgeons would go in for them, despite how dangerous surgery was at the time. And how exactly does this affect the head? Because like we've said, we're not really aware from the public record that people ever cut into people's skulls for stones at the time.
Right.
But maybe, just maybe, there's one sort of cranial phenomenon we could look at as a possible candidate for what's going on here, if this is intended to depict a real scene.
Yeah, if you're just saying, is it remotely possible
that
this could happen? Yeah.
That Bosch is depicting something that could have really happened. And here we want to talk about the meningioma. So a meningioma is a name for like a class of tumors that affect the brain and the spinal cord, though they actually don't grow from brain or spinal cord tissue itself, but from the meninges or the meninges, which are thin layers of tissue that wrap around the outside of these organs. So around the outside of your brain, you've got a thin layer of this tissue, and this is where this meningioma can occur. It's like a tumor. And because they appear on this outer tissue, they typically happen at the top or the outer curve of the brain, also sometimes at the base of the skull. But this would make sense in the picture, right? The top or the outer curve of the brain.
Yes.
That's where we see Bosch's tin funnel hat wearing doctor, might be the generous word, cutting here. So these tumors are typically non-cancerous. They're containing cysts or calcifications, interestingly. So that would be collections of minerals, you know, stone formations, just like you might have in your bladder or something. So a mineral collection or cyst. But of course, since they grow, they press against the brain. Even though they're non-cancerous, they still need to be removed. So this could be what we're seeing in the painting. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think in terms of just, I don't think it is what we're seeing, but in terms of making an argument, what is it possible? Is it realistically possible that there could be a stone of madness? Like this is the closest real world possibility.
Yeah.
And
in what case would it be a stone of madness?
Well, there's a paper that referred to. This is a 2002 letter to Neurology India by Prasad Krishnan, and a few other co-authors as well. And they were looking at a particular individual that that had one of these meningiomas growing inside the skull. And they found that it can result in irrelevant speech, forgetfulness, behavioral abnormalities such as disinhibition, emotional liability, and just excessive talking.
Huh.
So specifically, they looked at a 65-year-old patient, and they actually performed a craniotomy and gross total excision of the lesion, cutting her, curing her of all the symptoms in the process. So in other words, this is one case in 2012 with, of course, modern surgical tools and procedures at hand. The surgeons were able to remove a stone-like growth from a human skull and in doing so, cure the individual of their abnormal mental state.
Huh. Okay. So while we have no evidence that operations like this took place in the Middle Ages or Bosch's time, it is at least possible that this could be the kind of thing going on here.
Yeah. So in a sense,
it would sort of match the scene described.
Yeah. So it might be a case where accidentally art ends up giving us a glimpse of what an actual surgeon's blade would one day uncover.
Okay. Well, I've got another question though. One of the things that when I was researching medieval surgery, I came across is that one of the most common surgical procedures in medieval Europe would have been, treatment of battlefield wounds.
Yeah.
So what if what we're actually seeing is something that is, that has not just grown inside the head, not a stone of madness, but a missile of madness, something that has come from the outside and is being treated or removed?
Yeah. I mean, indeed, contemporary and ancient use of trepanation, it was often employed to deal with head trauma, either to, you know, mitigate brain swelling due to a blow to the skull, or to remove a bone fragment or even a missile of some sort from underneath the skull or in the skull or possibly in the brain. So I think you could make a granted weak case for the stone of folly having some relation to battle injury. Only in this case, you've not been hit by a stone from the enemy sling, but rather a dose of folly from the fate, I guess.
Yeah, when I was preparing for this episode, one of the things I did was I watched part of a short documentary that had a scene about an injury that the young Henry V actually suffered on the battlefield when he was a teenager, where he got an arrow lodged in his head. Uh-huh. And they were talking about what happened when it was a non-fatal wound. But, at the time, of course, if they leave the arrowhead in your wound, it's going to get infected and you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about the procedures that the surgeons of the day went through to try to remove this arrowhead from his head. And eventually he lived, he survived the procedure, but this does kind of show how even at a time when surgery is known to be very dangerous, if you've got a major head wound, you really don't have any other choice.
Yeah. It's either do it and possibly die or just die.
Yeah.
All right. So this brings us back though to the painting itself. So we've already established that cutting for your urinary stones was complicated and dangerous treatment, 50% mortality rate. Furthermore, trepanation was an even riskier proposal at the time, perhaps as high as 90% mortality rate, maybe even more depending on who's trying to carry it out. So whether cutting into the brain or bowel, surgical practices of the time were just not up to snuff.
Yeah.
And as far as treatment of madness goes, this was an age before psychiatry was even a word. We didn't get that until 1808. The four humors still held sway over our understanding of human experience. There were very few treatments for mental illness. The asylum was really one of the few options for individuals who really had severe mental illness.
Which wasn't really a treatment.
Right. And that's actually one of the arguments for Peter Bruegel the Elder's painting cutting out of the Stone of Madness, which you said it looks like a madhouse.
Yeah.
One argument is that he was depicting the brutal treatment of afflicted individuals within the madhouse, not that they were actually carved upon and had stones pulled out of their heads, but that the treatment they received was comparable to that level of brutality and ineffectiveness.
Okay, so yeah, it's sort of just like an extreme example that's fictional to communicate the reality of the total picture of the conditions, much like you might say use this not really very plausible scenario of waking up in a bathtub, missing a kidney, to depict the general sort of, lawlessness of a society or something like that.
Right.
You know, the predatory nature of wherever you are, Las Vegas or something.
Yeah. Now, in terms of actual trepanation, it was certainly on the table for head trauma, and psychosurgery was proposed in Europe as early as the 12th century, but there were actually very few reports of it being effectively employed before the 20th.
Yeah.
So it seems like the predominant theory here is that this painting is, there are a number of things going on, but one possibility here is that it's less about an actual surgery and more about a symbol for the ineffectiveness of surgery as a whole.
Yeah. So it's not just about our cruelty, but also about our ignorance and fumbling.
Yeah. Like we have such a disastrous record removing these stones that are occurring in the body.
Yeah.
Let's just push it into a more comedic and symbolic, area by having the quack surgeon, or perhaps just surgeon with a blundering and incomplete understanding of human physiology, and imagine then him operating on an even more dangerous part of the human anatomy, the brain itself, and then trying to remove some stone from that part of the body as well. So in Bosch's painting, it seems that it's less about this being an actual procedure that was attempted, but more, alright, let's take the stone removal surgeries that we know were occurring and that we know had such a disastrous record. Let's extrapolate that and then, and take our fictional doctor, who's either a quack or just a blundering but well-meaning individual who's dealing with just a limited understanding of human physiology and disease and infection. And let's have him not operate on this already dangerous part of the human body, but let's have him operate on an even more dangerous area for surgery, the human brain itself. Let's have him pull a stone out of there.
Yeah, so it's sort of a fictional symbol of not only not just like Bruegel's vision of the cruelty and chaos of the madhouse, but also of our just lack of knowledge and the way we fumble through medicine.
Yeah. And there are additional interpretations that are sometimes thrown in as well. The quack, interpretation that we mentioned already, that is essentially psychic surgery.
Yeah.
There's also the idea that the folly here is the patience for wishing the swift, easy removal of a thing, which must be won either spiritually or, via the mysteries of alchemy.
Yeah. A fool and his money are easily parted.
Yeah.
Another one of the interpretations that I'm not sure I can agree with, but I at least found very interesting and liked, came from that paper you referenced, A Stone Never Cut For, which it was interesting to read. They pointed out the three people in the painting. So the patient is laying in this chair, suffering, as you said, reclining, seeming to groan. Oh, get it out. You've got the doctor cutting him, and then you've got the monk, and then you've got the lady sitting there with the book on her head.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they interpreted the painting was that he's surrounded by symbolic characters embodying medicine, religion, and philosophy.
Ah,
and so that none of them really offer him a solution.
The philosopher being what looks like a nun with the closed book, the sealed book, resting atop her head.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I buy that interpretation, but I like it.
Yeah. I like it too. And she still looks more like a nun than a philosopher to me, but yeah, that's the rough thing about interpreting these older pieces of art, is they were not meant to speak to me or you. They were meant to speak to an individual, living in the time.
Yeah.
So they're kind of speaking across time and space here, and we can just do our best to try and interpret them. But I do like that interpretation because it extrapolates it beyond, mere medical science. And it just shows this, it's a comical take, but also one that, that kind of just pokes fun at our attempts to master anything. Here are the three learned individuals, and what are they accomplishing with against this individual's pain, discomfort, or madness?
Boredom.
Yeah. All right. So there you have it. I'm going to make sure that the landing page for this episode links to examples of all the works of art that we referenced here, so you can pull them up, look at them, draw your own conclusions, make your own interpretations about what's going on. We'll also link to that, to some of the papers that we referenced here as well.
But I'd say if you are feeling not quite well in your mind or in your mental state, let us advise you, don't cut for the stone or pay anyone else to cut for the stone. Go see a modern medical doctor.
And if that doctor has a tin funnel on his or her head,
pay extra.
pay extra. Yes. All right. Hey, in the meantime, be sure to visit stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes. You'll find videos. You'll find blog posts. You'll find links out to our social media accounts. Follow us there. We're on Facebook and Twitter as Blow the Mind. We're on Tumblr as Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
And if you want to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or to let us know your favorite mystery from an ancient or medieval painting, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.